with medical experts from Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, the Cleveland Clinic, and more, this is Med Clinic Radio.
Med Clinic Radio.
Exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Here's your host, Gina Tedesco.
People grow old at different rates, regardless of what the calendar says, and research from Duke University suggests that doctors should identify and treat the diseases of old age by the time people celebrate their 45th birthday before the problems escalate. Then, many people may be living with a serious heart condition and not even know it, but the signs and symptoms can be vague, so people often think they're just out of shape or getting older. This week's Mayo Clinic Q&A segment looks at symptoms, diagnosis, and treatment of atrial fibrillation. And a recent study from Stanford University found the majority of mass shootings in America might be prevented with aggressive action to identify and treat psychiatric disorders. Stick around. Med Clinic Radio gets underway in a moment.
Welcome back to Med Clinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
You might not need a rocking chair in your 40s, but recent research led by Duke University suggests that individuals and even society would benefit if doctors began identifying and treating old age diseases in patients as young as 45. The findings appear in the journal Nature Aging. Joining us now to discuss this is Maxwell Elliott, a PhD student in Duke University's Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. He was the study's lead author. Mr. Maxwell, other than perhaps crow's feet and some sore muscles after doing too much yard work, many of us sort of shrug off the signs of aging. But do we know what percentage of people show signs of serious aging even in their mid-40s?
Yeah, part of my interest in this field is thinking about aging really as a continuous process that happens to everyone at all times. So it really isn't something that happens to some people and not others. And it's something that happens beginning in your early life. So instead of waiting until people are in their 60s to start thinking about aging, I really think aging is interesting throughout the whole lifespan.
And are these people who age more quickly than others, that is, those who start showing signs in their 40s?
Yeah, for sure. There definitely are people who are accelerating faster, and the faster you're aging in your 40s already starts to show up in terms of how well you can see and hear, how worried you are about your health. There's plenty of ways that even in your 40s, aging is starting to show up and affect your daily life.
And you say the signs of dementia and physical frailty can be evident even in our mid-40s. What types of frailty are we talking about?
Some of the more interesting findings in the aging literature are things like how fast you walk across a room. People who are aging faster already seem to have challenges with their feet and their legs and their balance even that slow them down in how fast they walk across the room. So it kind of shows up in lots of different areas of your life, especially in things related to health.
And the point of this is to encourage interventions to blunt the effects of aging early on?
Yeah, I really think that shifting the way we think about aging so that we care about aging earlier in life hopefully would help us develop treatment so that we can slow the effects of aging before they're really starting to cement and kind of become harder to treat when you're already older and experiencing the more severe effects of dementia and Alzheimer's.
Not only does this affect them personally, but it affects society as a whole. In what ways does that effect take place?
It's part of our just general conversation that we're constantly having in our country about healthcare, for sure. Many of the healthcare dollars we spend on age-related disease because age-related diseases are pretty much all diseases that affect people once they become into their 50s and 60s. And lots of the money we spend on healthcare dollars go to diseases like heart disease, cancer, diabetes, dementia, Alzheimer's. And these diseases overwhelmingly happen to people who are aging the fastest in our society and who are the oldest in our society.
We're visiting with Maxwell Elliott in Duke University's Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. He was the lead author on a study into aging that suggests healthcare providers should address early aging signs more aggressively. Your study reviewed data gathered over years for several biomarkers related to aging, such as changes in heart and kidney functions. Can you tell us what were the other biomarkers?
We had 19 different biomarkers that we measured across the entire body. A lot of these biomarkers came from the blood, so things that many of our listeners might be familiar with, like how much cholesterol you have, different measures of the lipids and the fats in your blood. We also measured things that are a little bit uncommon in how we think about aging, but we really are interested in, like, how healthy are your teeth? How many cavities do you have? How quickly are your gums receding? And what we find is that there's a lot of shared information across the entire body in how fast your body is declining. And all of these different markers of different organ systems' health together give us a really nice picture of how quickly you're aging.
It's so interesting that you mentioned dental health, because I think most of us consider ourselves being able to impact that more than we might have an impact on, say, how our liver's doing.
Absolutely. I mean, really, we can impact our health in lots of different ways, but it is kind of uplifting to think that when your mom and dad were really angry at you for not brushing your teeth when you were a kid, that they might have in part been helping you age a little slower by maintaining your gum and teeth health into older life.
Now, some of the 45-year-olds you studied were actually aging more slowly than the average person. What indicators led to that conclusion?
The way we quantified aging was really thinking about across these 19 biomarkers, how quickly you are aging on average across 20 years. So we measured people for 20 years and we measured how quickly they're aging across these biomarkers. And what we found is that some people are actually aging about half as quickly as the average person in our study. And their biomarkers just kind of stayed flat. They declined very slowly and they really just were not losing health. Their gums were not receding. Their lung health was just as good as it was in their 40s as it was in their 20s. So it's exhilarating to think of like who those people are and how are they maintaining their health.
And the flip side of the coin, some 45-year-olds in your study were aging more rapidly. What were the signs in their cases?
So it's kind of exactly the flip side of that coin. There really were marked changes in those individuals between the time they were in their 20s and in their 40s. They had lots of cavities. They had lost lots of teeth. Their lungs were not functioning as they were before. They were much more likely to have early signs of diabetes, lung disease, heart attacks. These chronic diseases were already kind of rampant in the section of our population that was aging the fastest.
Up next on MedClinic Radio, more about early aging and why it's something we should pay attention to. Back in a moment.
Let's return to MedClinic Radio with your host, Gina Tedesco.
We're back now with Maxwell Elliott of Duke University's Department of Psychology and Neuroscience. He was the lead author on a study published in the journal Nature Aging, suggesting that identifying and treating diseases of old age should start, for some, by age 45. You and your colleagues created a database within a study in New Zealand in the 1970s. That had enrolled 1,037 babies born in 1972 to 73. Maxwell, describe what types of data those researchers were collecting and still do.
This study is really just a rich wealth of information that we have about these 1,000 individuals' lives. When the study began, it was a study of childhood development. People were really just interested in how much does your parenting and kind of the life circumstances in the first few years of life affect your readiness for school and your likelihood of getting good grades throughout middle school and high school. And then from there, researchers in health really kind of grabbed onto the study and realized what a unique opportunity it was to follow these individuals into midlife.
And your team actually established a means of measuring the biological aging process in earlier studies using those 19 distinct health factors. You started to mention some of them before. Can we revisit that and see what factors were collected regularly among this group to establish this means of measuring the biological aging process?
Yeah. When individuals were in their 20s, we really started getting interested in their biological health and different ways that we can measure. And some of these measures come from measures that you might get when you go to the doctor. So like we drew some blood and we measured cholesterol and lipids. And then we got measures from those as well of like how healthy your kidneys and your liver is, because there's certain metabolites that we can measure from that. We also were interested in measures like lung health. So how big of breaths can you take and how efficiently are you processing oxygen? So we really measured lots of different measures, from 19 measures from across the body, to try to get this full vision of how someone's organs are functioning.
And it's crucial, isn't it, that everyone in the study group is of the same age?
Yeah, that's a particularly unique design feature that we really cared a lot about in this study, which is that they're all born in one calendar year in the same hospital in the South Island of New Zealand. So we can easily isolate differences that are due to what we call biological aging. Because they're all the same chronological age, if someone seems to look older or their lungs seem to function as if they are older adult, or if their teeth look like they're rapidly aging, we know that it's not because they're actually older, because we know that we measured them all in the same year in the same place in New Zealand.
So based upon the data you reviewed, you assigned an aging rate to each person. And this sounds very interesting to me. Was this kind of a ratio, such as, let's say, 1.5 would mean the person ages 1.5 years compared to an average person aging 1 year?
Exactly. So the way we designed that measure was to average across the decline in all of these different biomarkers so that we could say, exactly as you're saying, if someone looks like they're aging twice as fast biologically as we might expect that they would on average.
And you say the pace of aging strongly indicates the cumulative, progressive, and gradual deterioration of a person's internal organs. So let's shift our focus for just a second here. What kinds of things can be done, interventions, to combat this deterioration in the midlife years?
This is an area that we're particularly interested in, and I think every human is probably interested in. A lot of things we know are just common sense things, like eating healthy, getting consistent exercise, staying connected to your friends. These all have been shown in other studies to slow the pace of aging and improve health over time. And now we, using measures like ours of biological aging, we have more evidence for more innovative treatments like caloric restriction, limiting the amount of calories you have in a day, and intermittent fasting, like skipping breakfast so that you only eat within a smaller period of time. And this is a really active area of research that our study is a stepping stone towards hopefully developing more of these novel interventions so that we can give people more tools to slow their aging. So if you can measure the pace of biological aging, we can then test whether any given intervention might actually slow it down over time.
We've been talking with Maxwell Elliott, a PhD student in Duke University's Department of Psychology and Neuroscience, on a study suggesting doctors identify and treat early aging starting as early as perhaps age 45. Does your study suggest that more aggressive screening for Alzheimer's would be appropriate for people in their 40s?
It's a really interesting question. Our study suggests that we can think about aging and we can roll back the clock on Alzheimer's to middle life for sure, because we know the biggest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease and other dementias is chronological age. Just the older you get, the more likely you are to develop these chronic diseases of the brain. So if we could measure that, actually, that aging process over and above just asking someone, what year were you born? Then we could start to find those people who are at highest risk because their bodies are actually aging faster and hopefully help them slow that down. So I'm a big fan of using these types of tools earlier in life to give people insight into their own aging process.
And it begs the question, all this, does early aging necessarily signal an early death is coming, or could it be a longer life with physical and other frailties?
Yeah, it's another really good question that we're actively researching. So we're using measures like our own and measures we've developed off of these pace of aging measures to test this question in older adult studies who are in later life and who are kind of closer to death, so that you can tell to what extent pace of aging does predict these different outcomes. And to the extent that we have information so far, it seems to be the case, I mean, it is a little morbid, that those who are aging the fastest are more likely to die sooner and are more likely to suffer disability earlier in life. So it really is a kind of a double whammy that we want to do our best to prevent as much as we possibly can.
And in the New Zealand study you mentioned before about the types of data collected, of course, all of them born in the same calendar year and in the same hospital. But was there any data collected related to genetic factors that point to aging?
In this particular study, we did not look at genetic factors, but we do have genetic data, and it is something we've been particularly interested in historically with this study. However, a kind of recent development in genetics is that you really can't learn a lot from any one study of our size, about 1,000 people. So what we've done with our genetic data is we've contributed to larger consortia, where you take a study like ours of 1,000 people and you combine it with another couple hundred studies that each have a couple thousand people, and you can get enough data to actually start to detect more reliable markers of genetics. So our goal is to really supply this information and participate in these consortia.
And did your study in any way control for environmental factors, including things such as what people ate, etc.?
In our study, we were really focused on like this kind of descriptive level of analysis. We're not really discriminating between what might have caused someone to be faster or slower aging. We're really just interested in understanding how much variation there is in the population. So it's a really interesting question, and it's something that we're actively going after, of what early life factors might lead someone to be more likely to age faster or slower. So it's a great, interesting question that we're very interested in.
And finally, Medicare and Social Security are based on chronological age. But do you believe there should be a shift to decide when benefits can come based on a person's biological age?
I'm happy you brought this up, because I think it's a particularly interesting implication of our study for sure. So when the age for Social Security, for example, was set, the average life expectancy, it was set to age 65 when the average life expectancy was right about 65 in our country. However, we've kept the same chronological age cutoffs, but the life expectancy now is 10, 15, 20 years later. So if our goal with these large scale social programs is to, in part, help people when they're starting to suffer from disability and chronic disease due to aging, we could do better to actually target people based on the pace at which they're aging and the likelihood they are to develop chronic diseases. So I think measures like ours that measure the pace of aging more directly could represent really interesting ways of redesigning how we target individuals who could most benefit and could most likely help from preventing the continued age-related decline, and just help them when they have chronic diseases later in life before it's too late and before they're in this kind of limbo zone of not being too disabled to hold down a job, but not being old enough to get Social Security or Medicare benefits.
Maxwell Elliott of Duke University's Department of Psychology and Neuroscience, thank you for joining us today and sharing your study with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next on this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A segment, many people may be living with a serious heart condition called atrial fibrillation and not even know it. Do you know the signs and symptoms of AFib? You will if you stay with us for more Med Clinic Radio.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Joel Streed. If one member of a family has celiac disease, there is a likelihood other members will be affected as well, says Dr. Joseph Murray.
Family members who have somebody in a family with celiac disease are much more likely to have celiac disease than the general population.
Gluten is a protein in wheat, barley, and rye, and it can cause damage in the intestine for those with celiac disease. Common symptoms include
abdominal pain, diarrhea, bloating, excess gas, fatigue, anemia.
Dr. Murray says because of the genetic component, family members should consider being screened.
You can do a blood test, and the blood test, if it's positive, indicates a likelihood of celiac disease.
Avoiding gluten is the only treatment. If you have symptoms and think you might have celiac disease, Dr. Murray says to get tested before changing your diet. For more information, talk with your healthcare provider or visit mayoclinic.org.
You're listening to Med Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
Welcome back. Millions of Americans are affected by a serious heart condition called atrial fibrillation. Dr. Helena Gazelka takes a look at that on this week's Mayo Clinic Q&A segment.
Atrial fibrillation, or AFib as it is sometimes known, is an irregular and often rapid heartbeat that can increase your risk of strokes, heart failure, and other cardiac problems. Episodes of atrial fibrillation can be self-limited or they can go on for a period of time and need treatment. Although atrial fibrillation itself isn't usually life-threatening, it is a serious medical condition, and it sometimes requires emergency treatment. Here with us to discuss this today is Mayo Clinic cardiologist Dr. Christopher DeSimone. Dr. DeSimone subspecializes in cardiac electrophysiology. So what happens to the heart when someone has atrial fibrillation?
It's right. So the way I like to explain it to patients is the heart is like a two-story building. You have the top as well as the bottom floor, the basement. And the basement's where the money is, the real contraction and the strength of the heart pumping blood to the rest of the body. The top is kind of like where everybody kind of hangs out. And those are the filling chambers. But for those to coordinate and beat in a fashion that's manageable for life and to not give people symptoms, these are all dictated by various cells in the heart, which could coordinate electrical conduction with mechanical contraction of the heart. So in atrial fibrillation, the top of the heart is kind of going irregular. And what I explain to my patients is this is like a bag of worms. It's kind of like trying to squeeze, but not squeezing efficiently. And when it's doing that, two things are happening. One, the heart's not filling adequately and pumping blood out to the rest of the body. And you can imagine people could get symptoms such as headaches, lightheadedness, dizziness. Some people get chest pain. And overall, a lot of people just feel crummy and malaise. And also the pressures in the left side of the heart back up and they start to get higher. And that's where people could get really short of breath because that chamber is what's taking blood that's oxygenated from the lungs. And the pressure sort of builds up in the lungs and gives people a really uncomfortable feeling.
I love your analogies. Two-story houses and bags of worms. I can picture it all. Chris, how common is atrial fibrillation?
It's very common. So the thing I would say there's sort of probably around 5 or 7 million people that are suffering with AFib that's estimated. Oh. But the more worrisome thing is it might be much more common than that. And why? Because people don't walk around saying, hey, I'm in atrial fibrillation. Come treat me. They don't know. And maybe they're accustomed, or maybe they say, oh, you know, I'm just getting older. This is just the way life is going to be. And they're not used to it until it's picked up in the office with their primary care provider at a PAMI visit for preoperative for surgery. That's classic. So you hear the patient got, you know, this was found right before the patient was getting a colonoscopy. So it's incidentally found. And then patients say, that's what's been going on. You know, I could tell this has been going on for a couple of years. And the second thing that's very concerning is that there's an estimation that this could double or even triple in the next decade or so. So it's going to be common and more common as the population ages and we have a growing population.
Chris, the one thing I thought of when you're describing the symptoms is that I could imagine that people, as they're growing older, may write off the fact that they just feel kind of lousy or they are a little fatigued or maybe a little more short of breath because maybe we just think, well, I guess I'm getting a little older. I can excuse that.
Exactly. And what happens is, you know, it's a good feeling for me, but I imagine it's a bad feeling for them because once I'm able to get them back into normal rhythm, they say, oh my goodness, I wish I would have had this taken care of. I didn't realize how bad it was. So I think to make people feel better sooner and quicker and to make them aware of some of these symptoms and get evaluated would be a great, great deal for our patients.
You mentioned that there might be even more people with atrial fibrillation in the future. Chris, what causes people to develop atrial fibrillation?
There's a whole bunch of comorbidities that could cause this. Mainly things that are really, really in parallel with developing atrial fibrillation is when someone has longstanding high blood pressure or hypertension. Also, if someone has sleep apnea, that's another trigger towards this. Sometimes things are in combination of alcohol use and caffeine, or if their thyroid hormones are off balance, those are all triggers. But it seems to be that our best predictor is the longer we age or the more we age, that's when atrial fibrillation starts to come. And that's probably because of longstanding or unnoticed or untreated hypertension, but also because you have stretch and scar and fibrosis in the top chamber of the heart, which makes it much easier for atrial fibrillation to happen.
So how do you diagnose this and make certain it isn't some other arrhythmia or something else?
Very important, right? Because if we diagnose it, we are able to say, you have this, and what are the next steps in your treatment care plan to do this? The best way to diagnose this, you know, some people are really, really good and say, well, you're a regular on physical exam and we're listening to your heart or looking at your neck veins and cardiac pulsations. Some people could pick it up now with the Apple Watches or iPads and iPods, all of these things. But really, the gold standard is to document this rhythm on an EKG.
And then how do you treat it once you know it's there?
Well, that's a great question. And treatment all depends on what the patient's feeling. Some patients are what we call asymptomatic, and they're not aware they're in atrial fibrillation whatsoever. If that's the case, the best treatment for those patients are to make sure their heart rate doesn't go over 100 beats per minute in a 24-hour period, that their heart's not weakened from being in atrial fibrillation, and based on a risk score that we use, criteria, whether or not they need to be on blood thinning medication to prevent stroke, because stroke is the worst part of atrial fibrillation. Fivefold at least risk of stroke if patients are in atrial fibrillation.
Why
so
is
those
that,
are the
Chris?
Key. It's more so of what we call, it's kind of like the appendix of the heart. It's called the left atrial appendage, and it's felt that 90 to 95% of the clots form there. What happens is you have blood stasis and pooling, and it's kind of this reservoir in the heart that kind of just fills up, and it kind of curdles itself like cheese, milk and cheese, and it kind of just stays there. And because that's on the left side of the heart, that could embolize to the brain and cause patients a stroke, unfortunately.
Hmm. What does it mean when someone has an ablation procedure for atrial fibrillation?
So our strategies would be rate controlling medicine, so we keep the heart rate low or within a reasonable range to protect the heart from getting weaker. Other options, what we term rhythm controlling approaches. And that means let's keep you out of atrial fibrillation because you feel better and or the pumping function in your heart's better when you're in normal sinus rhythm. And that's what we call normal rhythm, sinus rhythm. It's the rhythm that God gave us. Here's our electricity pacemaker in the heart that God gave us when we were all born, and let's stay in that. And an ablation procedure is one attempt at rhythm when either a drug, an antiarrhythmic drug, fails or a patient cannot tolerate or doesn't prefer to be on an antiarrhythmic agent. And what we do for the ablations is we know where the triggers and where the atrial fibrillation sort of monsters lie. And these are at the top chamber, you know, the top of the house on the left side. And these are called pulmonary vein triggers. So when we're all born, we grow out our lung buds from the heart, and some of those lung veins, which are going to, again, in adult life and in all types of life, will bring oxygenated blood from the lungs and drop it into the left atrium, the top chamber of the heart. Some of the left atrial tissue is pulled into the veins itself, and those are the triggers. So, for example, another analogy, those are like matchsticks, I tell my patients. They get very angry, and then you start throwing little matchsticks on fire into the heart. And the heart's like a stack of logs. And one of those matches are going to catch and set the heart on fire. And that's what starts off atrial fibrillation. So an approach is catheter-based ablation, where I'm sure our listeners may have heard or know somebody that have had coronary angiograms, where they go up through the groin arteries to look at the blood flow in the heart. This, we go up through the veins in the groins. We go up into the heart with several catheters. We use a pretty cool, it's almost like a video game. We use a 3D mapping system to try to figure out where the heart is in space and time and measure that up with where our catheters are, which could also tell us where we are in space and time. What we do is inside of the heart, but outside of the pulmonary veins, we try to form ablation lesions to kind of cage the tiger or cage these matchsticks from firing away. And that's a first and initial approach to patients to try to say, let's do what we can to reduce the likelihood you'll go into atrial fibrillation. Let's make it really hard for you to go back into atrial fibrillation. It's not a cure, but as I tell my patients, think about it as taking a one-time really great drug.
Well, speaking of drugs, when people are controlled or treat their atrial fibrillation with medications, are they usually on them for life?
Any ablation we do, because we cannot cure atrial fibrillation for anything, drugs or ablation, still doesn't affect their stroke risk. So patients will still be on blood thinners lifelong if they necessitate based on their risk criteria. So ablation, drugs, anything, no matter if there's sinus rhythm or not, they still will be on blood thinners lifelong. Now, in terms of whether they need to be on the other agents, that's all depending on how well the ablation takes, how well their body, as well as the risk factor modifications, such as exercise, weight loss, controlling their sleep apnea and blood pressure takes place. But it's very common for us to get patients off of all of those, quote, antiarrhythmic medications after ablation procedures. Sometimes patients have more advanced forms of atrial fibrillation, and they need both catheter ablation plus a drug.
Chris, I want to go back to something you just said, where you said it depended somewhat on if they modified their risk factors, exercised, manage their sleep apnea, et cetera, et cetera. So can you reverse your atrial fibrillation, or does reducing your risks stop you from having it?
There's been large studies that show such a benefit if patients do weight loss and risk factor modification. It's almost on the same parallel as our best drug in cardiology. It's really, really good. And reversing it would kind of be taking it to where you don't have much atrial fibrillation. And also reversing it means you could change the substrate of your heart, meaning the top chamber of the heart kind of says, oh, I like being in atrial fibrillation. I'm scarring up. I'm seeing all these pressures. I'm changing. I'm becoming more stiffer. But if you could keep patients in sinus rhythm and they stay in it, you could cause what we call left atrial remodeling. So remodeling of that chamber of the heart, and patients do very, very well with that approach. So I would say that all three of these, risk factor modifications, catheter ablation, plus or minus drugs, as well as blood thinners, are mainstays in our treatment for atrial fibrillation.
Well, Chris, I'm an anesthesiologist and I learned something new today. Anything else that you want to share with our listeners today?
I just really appreciate this opportunity, because atrial fibrillation's out there. More of it's unfortunately likely going to come. And I think our patients have lots and lots of questions. And to see this in their chart or to be told about it, I hope our video makes them more informed, less scared, and likely to come see us and visit with us and have this discussion, because we could really improve their quality of life, reduce their risk of stroke, intervene early, and have a good impact on their quality of life.
I do think it is amazing what a difference it can make to have heard those words before, atrial fibrillation, before you just encounter it somewhere.
I think so. And patients really do feel tremendous improvement in their quality of life when we keep them in normal rhythm. So I think this is fantastic, and I thank you very much.
Well, thanks for being here, Chris. Our thanks to Mayo Clinic cardiologist and cardiac electrophysiologist, Dr. Chris DeSimone, for being here with us today to talk about this important topic of atrial fibrillation.
Mayo Clinic Q&A is produced by the Mayo Clinic News Network and is available wherever you find your favorite podcasts and at newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org. Coming up in a moment, a groundbreaking study from Stanford University that looked at mass shooters and their mental states. That's next on Med Clinic Radio.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. Oh, dashboard light problems? We can help. Our free Fix Finder service can read your check engine light, ABS light, and service indicator light, and give you possible solutions, verified by licensed technicians. You'll even get detailed results sent straight to your email, so you have them when you need it most. It's the most complete free warning light report, backed by the most robust database of technician solutions. The free Fix Finder service, only at AutoZone. Restrictions apply.
Get in the zone, AutoZone!
Welcome back to MedClinic Radio. Once again, here's Gina Tedesco.
We see frequent headlines about mass shootings in the U.S. and ponder the causes of this senseless violence. Now, groundbreaking research published in the Journal of Clinical Psychopharmacology may shed some light on this. We're joined by the study's lead author, Ira Glick, M.D., professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine. Dr. Glick, before we get to the results of your research, tell us how you and your team gathered this data on mass shooters.
Sure. All the information we've had on mass shooters has come from the media, meaning newspaper accounts, television, etc. What we have done is the first scientific using medical data to identify who these people are. What we have done, and no one else has ever done this, is we have used a database of 115 mass shooters, 35 of whom lived after the shooting. The rest all died at the time of the crime. Of these 35, they were brought to court, and what we have done is used the court records, which are available publicly. They were interviewed by psychiatrists using the diagnostic criteria for medical psychiatric illness and the rest of the court records in order to determine who exactly these people are, rather than relying on media reports or friends or family of the perpetrators.
So what did your study find?
What we found, again, not consistent with the lay literature and even the psychologic, not medical literature, what we found is that in 28 of the 35 cases in which the assailant survived, they actually had a psychiatric diagnosis. That is, 18 with schizophrenia, 3 with bipolar disorders, 2 with delusional disorders, 2 with severe personality disorders, you know, very paranoid, and 2 with substance-related disorders, you know, like cocaine, heroin, without other psychiatric diagnosis, and 1 with what's called post-traumatic stress disorder. 4 of the 35 had no psychiatric diagnosis, and in 3 of the 35, we did not have enough information to make a diagnosis. The most important finding, because we know that patients with schizophrenia and other psychiatric disorders have a lower incidence of violence than the general population, lower. What we found is none of the cases was medicated prior to the crime or adequately medicated, but the answer is none. So the most important finding is that a significant portion of these experienced unmedicated and untreated psychiatric disorder.
We're talking with Ira Glick, MD, professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine, learning about his first-of-its-kind study that a large majority of mass shooters have psychiatric disorders for which they've received no medication or no other treatment. Dr. Glick, is it a reasonable conclusion that proactive treatment might have prevented some of these atrocities?
Correct. These were tragedies that could have been avoided. And the message we have is if you have a family member, friend, or know somebody who's paranoid, threatening, and obviously has what's in the lay press been called mental disorder, but we would call it brain disease, brain illness, brain damage, they need, even against their will, to get help that is diagnosed and treated, even against their will, to prevent these tragedies. That's the message.
There have been anecdotal reports that some of these shooters were simply off their meds.
That's why we always recommend, when we treat people with psychiatric illness, because they are cognitively impaired, in plain language, they can't think straight, I always try to work with a significant other, whether it's a family member, friend, somebody sleeping under an underpass with them, or a caseworker, or social worker, or whoever. I always work with them. And the most recent and important change in our treatments is to use long-acting injectable agents, where you can give an injection to somebody with these illnesses, which clears up a lot, not all, a lot of the paranoia and hallucinations and delusions, and they don't have to take it by mouth every day. They take it once a month. And again, important point, like it or not.
The percentage of Americans with serious mental illnesses who go on to commit horrifying crimes like mass shootings is minuscule, but any number is too large, isn't it?
That is 100% correct. It's a tiny fraction, but as you said, even one person is more than enough. We don't want 8, 10, 15, 20 shootings in schools or clubs, etc., or at workplaces.
Professor Ira Glick from the Department of Psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that's MedClinic Radio for this week. MedClinic Radio is a production of Syndication Networks. If you would like to listen to past shows, check out our website, medclinicradio.com. Our executive producer is Randy Meyer, and I'm your host, Gina Tedesco. Thanks for joining us, and we hope you join us again next week for another edition of MedClinic Radio. Syndication Networks.